Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. If you've got your Bibles this morning, let's find John chapter 2. John chapter 2 is where we're going to be at. We're going to be reading kind of what is the first story in the action kind of the gospel. And so last week we kind of finished up Jesus's kind of initial movements where he's been baptized and then he calls his first disciples. And so just to kind of recap, that's Andrew and Peter and then Philip and Nathaniel. And those four plus Jesus are kind of in the story that we're going to talk about this morning, all right? And so today's a fascinating story, and we're going to read it together, and then we're going to talk about it, and hopefully by the end we'll apply it to our lives and see what God has for us for this week that we need to be doing. All right, so here we go. John chapter 2, verse number 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. So Mary was already there. Verse 2, Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Ooh, kind of a bad thing. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, the people there at the party, handling, facilitating the party, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. All right, so that's anywhere from 120 total to 180 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called who? The bridegroom, the groom of the party. The groom of the wedding, and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, when the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This is the first of his, that's Jesus, the first of Jesus's signs. Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Verse 12, last one. After this, he went down to Capernaum, that's Jesus, went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers, that's his literal brothers, and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. All right, so that's the story. Jesus is at a wedding, does something that we'll talk about, and then we'll draw some applications from that. First, about what this parable says about, or story says about Jesus, and then what that has to do with us today. All right, so let's jump into the text. So at the beginning of the story, the Bible tells us that 3 days had passed. Now, that's 3 days from the previous events, which were what? Well, that's when Jesus decided to go to Galilee, and he had met Philip. And then Philip found Nathanael, and Nathanael was introduced to Jesus. And Nathanael said, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" And then Jesus has this interaction and says to Philip, "Hey, before Philip saw you, Nathanael, I saw you under the tree, under the fig tree." And Nathanael's overcome and says, "Truly, this man is the King of Israel, the son of God." And Nathanael believes in it. So it's 3 days later, after these events, that Jesus, the four disciples, Simon or Andrew, Peter, Philip, and Nathanael, and his mother are at a wedding in Cana of Galilee. Now, Cana, if you're looking on the map, is about 9 miles northeast of Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, and about 9 miles-ish from the nearest access point to the Sea of Galilee. So it's not on the Sea of Galilee. It's to the west of the Sea of Galilee, kind of in the interior of what would be known as Lower Galilee, in the general region that Jesus grew up in. And so Jesus, his mother, presumably his brothers are there too, because after the wedding they all leave and go to Capernaum. And his disciples, thank you, sir. And his disciples are at this wedding, and they are there. Now, let's talk about a Jewish wedding for just a minute, because a Jewish wedding is not like our weddings today. Our weddings today are for a few hours, right? You have the wedding ceremony, and then you have the wedding reception, and that's where you eat food and cake, and depending on the time of day the wedding is, depends on what you get served for dinner, for to eat. So if you were like us, when we got married and you didn't have a whole lot of money, you did that sucker at 2, making sure I got the time right. You know, you get in trouble if you don't remember all those details. At 2, why? Because it's after lunch, but before dinner. So you have some heavy hors d'oeuvres, and then cake, right? But then you go to some of these weddings that are at night, and it's a straight up meal, like at dinner, right? And y'all know, you get kind of honored if there's not a dinner when at dinner time, right? You know, they're trying to sell you little cheese and crackers at 7:30. It's like, no, I'm here for the food and to see y'all and get a picture so we can put it on Facebook, right? That's the deal, right? So anyway, however, a Jewish wedding, guess what? While the ceremony for the wedding would probably be very brief and not terribly long, the party could last for an entire week. And all the dads in the room with daughters are like, oh, could last a week. Now this, from the way the story reads, we realize this is toward the end of that time. Mary's been there, and Mary has some leadership role in this event. And at some point, the wine runs out. Now, a couple things. One, let's not try to be linguistic gymnast and say that this wasn't real wine. It was. It was absolutely wine. Now, could it have been cut with water? Probably so. Did they normally cut wine with water? Yes. Why? Because the alcohol in the wine would purify the unsanitary water that would have been common. So yes, wine was used to cut with water. However, by the head servant's reaction, at the end we know that what Jesus made wasn't diluted, because the guy said, this is the best of the best we've had so far. So let's not kid ourselves. Jesus created real wine. And they had drunk real wine at the party, right? So, get that out of the way. The bigger question is not whether it was wine or whether it was Welch's grape juice. That's not the biggest question. The biggest question you need to ask right now is, why is it a big deal that the wine ran out? Why didn't Mary just go, well, that's it, guys, we're done? It's the same reason that I have yet to have... or be a part of, or be associated with, or near a church eating where somebody doesn't ask somebody the question, do we have enough food? I sure hope we have enough food. Do we need to go to the store and buy more chicken? Do we need another ham? I hope we've got enough desserts. Y'all said it here. Every church I've been a part of has said that. Why? Because there's a social contract, an unwritten social rule, that if you invite people to your house for dinner, they need to leave eating as much food as they want, even if that means you got to eat cheese and crackers after dinner, after they've left. Correct? Come on, y'all, don't look at me like y'all don't know what I'm talking about. That's the deal. If I invite you over to our house for spaghetti, you get spaghetti first, right? Because you're guests. And then we get whatever's left. And you go home having seconds if you want it and 3 pieces of bread, and we'll just eat one. That's the deal. The same thing happens here. However, it's much worse. Because I doubt that if you only got 1 plate of spaghetti at our house and you really wanted 1.5, that you're going to go home and tell all of your friends, Pastor only let me have 1 plate of spaghetti and I really wanted 1/2 more. However, the next day in this village in Cana, that would have been the talk of the town. Because in Jewish society, there was an underlying kind of social idea called honor and shame that pervaded Jewish society. That means if you were deemed to have honor, then you were always looked in high regard. And you were always kept as a person of good standing in the community. However, if you were a person of shame, you were perpetually viewed as someone who was a step below everybody else. And an event like this would cast shame on the entire family that might be, and there's a bit of contingency here, but listen to me, that might be irreversible. In other words, at the next wedding, guess what the talk's going to be? Hey, I hope they don't run out. I hope they don't run out of wine like, oh, sorry, so-and-so did at the last wedding. Boy, he could have sprung. He's got enough money. He could have sprung for two more cases, two more jars of wine. And at the next wedding, hey, I sure hope they don't run out of wine. You remember how I was there? You remember how? And it goes on and on and on. And you may never recover as a family from running out of wine at one party, even though you've supplied wine for days. Because the society, social contract was built on honor and shame, and you providing food at any time and as much as they needed for the person who you invited as a guest. Now, you and I don't do it to that degree today, but we still want to ask, do we have enough food? Do we need more desserts? Do we need another chicken? So we get the idea. These guys in this time period take it to the extreme. That's a huge deal. And so Mary's a part of this leadership group who's kind of facilitating this wedding. And she comes up to Jesus and says, hey, they ran out of wine. And the idea of her, in the inflection in her voice is not, oh, well, they ran out of wine, Jesus. No, it's, hey, they've run out of wine with the implied assumption that you need to do something about it. Now, here's the question that I have as I read this. Why does she think that Jesus can do anything about it? Right? Like, Jesus has not done any other miracles that we know of. Now, you could say, well, if we read Luke's gospel early in Luke's gospel, remember that story when Jesus is 12 and they're in the temple? If you haven't, you can go back and read it. It's in the first few chapters of Luke. It's the only story from Jesus' childhood that we have. Jesus is 12 years old and everybody goes to Jerusalem for a festival and they're traveling in like parties, big family parties, multiple people. And Joseph and Mary lose track of Jesus at 12 years old. And they get like a full day's journey down the road or whatever. And they realize, we thought Jesus was a grandma or his aunt or his uncle. Jesus nowhere to be found. So then Mary and Joseph have to hightail a day's journey back to Jerusalem. And realize Jesus has been in the temple confounding the religious elites by his knowledge of the scriptures. That's the only indication of anything we have of what Jesus did as a child. But yet Mary instinctively comes up to him and says, hey, you got to do something about this. Now, Jesus' response, let's be honest. Jesus' response to us sounds very harsh. Very harsh. Right? But here's what you need to realize. It's not as harsh as it sounds in English. In fact, what you're reading in Jesus' answer to Mary, or response to Mary, which we'll get a little bit more into it in a second, but the first thing where Jesus says, woman, what does this have to do with me, is what's called a semitism. Okay? A semitism is something that is It's colloquially significant for Jesus in his day, but it doesn't really make as much sense to me. Make as much sense to us today because we live in a different culture. It's a cultural saying. So if you literally took the words that make up this sentence, they don't really make sense. It literally means lady, woman, dear lady, what do you and me? That's literally what the words mean. It's something very simple. I could be off a little bit, but that doesn't really make sense, right? But those words stand for something else. We have these as well. Let me give you a few. We would call these Southernisms. So if I were to say And this may be new for some of us, but if I were to say, that's as rare as hen's teeth, what do I mean? That's really rare. Now, if I were to say to you, man, that was like pulling teeth, what do I mean? That was hard. And I can even put the two together. And I can say, man, that was like pulling hen's teeth. And what does that mean? That was really, really hard. Now, why does that not make real sense literally? Because if you've ever had hens, you realize they don't have no teeth. So you can't pull them, and they're not really rare because they don't have them to begin with. So literally, pulling hen's teeth, or that's as rare as hen's teeth, it doesn't make literal sense. But we know colloquially that that's a southernism for something's really hard or something's really rare. Or if you put them all together, that was really, really hard. Right? That's exactly what Jesus is doing here. If Jesus was southern, here's what it would sound like. Ma'am, why did you bring this to me? And you say, huh, why doesn't he use the word mom or mother? Mom, why did you bring this to me? And the answer is in what Jesus says after the question. What does he say after? My hour has not yet come. Now, what does that mean? Jesus uses the word hour throughout John's gospel to signify his death, burial, and resurrection. That is his moment. That is his, to use the other side of it, that is his time. That is the thing he came to do. And what he's telling his mother is that time ain't yet. And so what we realize is, A, Mary is trying to, if I can use these words, twist Jesus' arm to do something based on her relationship with him as his mother. She is in essence saying, Jesus, I'm your mother, you need to do this for me. Right? And Jesus is setting the ground rules right now. And he's saying, ma'am, just so you know, that's not the operation that's not the order of operation that we are under right now. Because more than Jesus was the son of Mary, he was the only begotten son of God. And what we see in Jesus' response is a clear delineation of who he is going to put in the place of priority first. And it's his father's plan, then his mother. Right? In fact, this same language that Jesus uses here of woman, what has this to do with me, is very similar to what Jesus says while he's dying on the cross, talking to Mary again, and John, the author of the gospel, the disciple, when he says, woman, your son, your mother. In other words, meaning, John, you're going to take care of my mom like she was your mom. But he uses the same word, woman. He doesn't use the word for mom. And what Jesus is showing us is clearly who he sees himself as first and prime place of priority is the only begotten Son of God who has a specific mission to do. And that mission is not yet fully realized today. It's in the shadows right now. Now, next week, if you be here next week, because Jesus is coming out of the shadows and into the direct spotlight next week with the action that happens in the rest of chapter 2. But right now, Jesus is saying, my time, not yet come. And so he's placing the will of the Father above the will of his own mother. Mary comes back in verse 5 and says, hey, y'all just do whatever he tells you to do. As if to say, okay, I got it, you're going to help. It just may not be the way I want you to help, right? So verse 6 tells us that here's where the miracle happened, verses like 6 through 10. Jesus takes these water jars. Now, think about it with me. You got to step outside the story a minute. Step outside the exact what John tells us. Step out a minute. You've had a, let's just hypothetically say, it's a 5-day party. How many vessels of wine do you think they've gone through already? How many cups and bowls, how many receptacles could Jesus have used for this miracle? They're everywhere. They're everywhere, right? There's probably stuff scrolled everywhere. There's any number of things that Jesus could use. So you have to ask the question, why does Jesus choose these six stone water jars? Let's talk about that for a minute, what they are. These six stone water jars are literally made out of stone. And they would be at the entrance of the house or the place where they're having the party. And they would be for, as the text tells us, for the Jewish rite of purification, which was simply that they would be filled with water and they would be used for ritual cleansing of people and of items that would be used at the party. So they would like wash their hands, they might wash their feet, they might wash the serving ware that they dipped the wine with or that they put the food on with, you know, like. And so these were not look at me, here's, you got to understand this difference. This was not for hygiene. This was for ritual purity, okay? Not necessarily for hygiene, although it would help with that. But it's for ritual purity. In other words, I have to do this or it will be unclean. Ritually unclean. Ritually separated from the Lord. You got it? Each one of these held 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus tells the waitstaff to go fill them up. This is key. To the brim. I mean, to the top. Like there's no more room in them for any other water. Fill them up to the brim. And they do that. Then Jesus says, draw some water out. Now, there's some discrepancy, or there's not discrepancy, that's a bad word. Commentators differ on where they took the water from. Did they take the water from the well, or did they take the water from the stone pots? I really don't think it matters that much, because what happens is, as the waitstaff draws water out and takes it to the chief, like, host of the party, at some point in the process, whether in the jar, in between the process, the water transitions to wine. It miraculously becomes wine. So good and such of great quality that the host of the party, the head guy of the party, says to the bride, not to Jesus, because he doesn't know that Jesus has done this, goes to the groom and says, hey dude, you've saved the best for last. In other words, we have yet to have wine that tasted this. Even the first wine that you served was not as good as this wine. Right? What is he saying? At the beginning of the party, the normal kind of course of events is when everybody's taste buds are fresh, we serve the best stuff. And then as the party goes on, taste buds diminish slightly, and we serve the cheaper stuff. And everybody's still okay. And what he's saying is, you've saved the best for last. Then John adds this in verse 11. He kind of gives us some editorial information. But verse 11 is crucial. 12 just tells us that they travel. But listen to verse 11 again. This is the first sign. Now John uses the word sign where we would call it a miracle. But he uses the word sign specifically because it signifies something about Jesus. So this is the first signifying event that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. And what did he do? Manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So here's the question we ought to ask. Because we've seen Mary's mother comes and says, hey, they've run out of wine. That's a problem because of honor and shame. Jesus says, hey, what does this have to do with me? Because why? I'm putting God's priorities above your priorities, ma'am. But then Jesus still, kind of semi-incognito, holds to his Father's will of not, it's not his time, but also helps his mother out who's running this party. And Jesus uses these six stone water jars for this miraculous changing of water into wine. And John tells us that's supposed to tell us something about Jesus. It's supposed to signify something about Jesus. So the question we've got to ask in our remaining times is, what does this tell us about Jesus? Or what does this signify about Jesus in the world in which he lived, and what does it have to do with us? So we're going to answer those two questions really quickly. The key to understanding what this story signifies about Jesus is held in those six water pots for the ritual purification. Those six water pots, again, Jesus could have chosen anything he wanted to put the water in that would become wine, correct? So why Jesus chose those is specific. He chose those because those signified or symbolized the entire ritual system of the Old Testament. Those six water pots that were filled up that were for what kind of cleansing? Hygiene? No, for ritual cleansing. Right? There's another story that appears in another gospel that we see the reverse, because Jesus' disciples eat with unwashed, they're at this party, kind of similar setting, and Jesus' disciples eat with unwashed hands. Right? And the Pharisees don't get on to him, or the religious leaders don't get on, or don't reprimand Jesus and his disciples because they're not being hygienic and they've got dirty hands. But they say, basically, why are you doing this? Because that's not what we're supposed to do. Because in order to be ritually clean, we got to do this. Right? You can go read that story. But here we see that Jesus takes those six water pots and he has them filled to the brim as a symbol, as a living example in this home, at this celebratory event, that old way of doing things is over. How much water did they put in there? Filled up to the what? To the brim. There is no more room for the old way of living. Why? Because new wine is in the room. New wine is in the room. In other words, God is doing something new in the world. In other words, the long-awaited newness that all of the Jews waited for was they would have to wait no longer, because new things, God's new thing in the world that He was doing, it was no longer having to wait for it, because it was in the world, in the room, in place. And Jesus uses these six water jars to show, listen to me, that we are out with the old and it's in with the new. Out with the old and in with the new. All the old way of ritualistic is out, because there's a new way coming and it is here in the world and it is revealing itself to the world for those who will see it. This idea of old way of living, Jesus continually interacts with throughout this gospel and the other three gospels, from religious leaders and from commoners, because people still continually want him to be associated, or they want to put him in the box of old way living. And Jesus continually pushes and pushes and bursts out of that old way of living. Why? Because God is doing something new in the person of Jesus Christ. Mainly through His death, His burial and resurrection and ascension back to heaven. Why? So that we could have ultimate forgiveness of sins. So, that's the main point of the parable. Yes, Jesus changes water to real wine, and that's a miracle. But it signifies that God is out with the old, in with the new, which He prophesied, which His prophets prophesied would come, would happen. It's a living example that Jesus is bringing newness into the world. So, the question we've got to remain, or that remains to be asked, which we'll answer now, is, so what in the world does this have to do with me? Right? What does this have to do with me today? Well, I think there's a lot of things we could talk about. We could talk about family relationships, right? We could talk about parents wanting their kids to do X, Y, and Z, but they feel like God's called them to do X, Y, and Z, and sometimes that don't mesh, right? That would be a great topic. We're not spending time on that today. We could. We could talk about the miraculous nature of Jesus' miracle, taking water and changing it into wine, which is a miracle over nature and agriculture and time, right? But there's the main point, I think, of application for today, all those would be great topics. The main point of application, I think, today is the main point of this story, which is out with the old and in with the new. Because listen to me, Jesus does the same thing in our hearts and lives that He does with these water jars. Because see, these old stony water jars that were used for old way of living, Jesus resurrects to new life by putting new wine in them and redirects their purpose from ritual stuff to celebratory drink for the whole party. I mean, they have 100 and no less than 120 gallons of wine. Not just wine, but of the best wine the party had seen. And in the same way, Jesus changes our old stony, hard hearts and breaks them and builds new life in them when we come to Him. And so Jesus has transformed our hearts just like He transformed the purpose of those ritual purity stone jars. They were meant for one thing. God renews them and gives them new purpose and new life, just like He does in our hearts and lives when we place faith and trust in Him. Here's the problem, though. Listen to me. We're almost done. Here's the problem. Some of us really like old way of living. And we struggle with going back to the old way of doing things. Come on now. You got accustomed to living one way, and Jesus transformed your life completely new, and after a while, you want to go back to the old way of doing things. Come on. Those old habits, that old way of living continually pulls at us and pulls at us and pulls at us. So that we're no longer living in Jesus' newness and freshness and life, but we're trying to live in a new life doing old things. And that don't work. Right? This happens not only this happens in daily life as well. I saw an article just this past week. I don't know if this applies to any of you in here, but I just saw it, right? Cell phone carriers are cutting off all of the 3G networks very soon. That means if you have a phone that doesn't do 4G, you're out of luck. You're going to be forced to get a new phone because there will be no network to support your 3G phone. It won't work. Why? Well, because they can do that. But another way, it's out with the old. And look at me. And before long, guess what's going to happen? All of our 4G phones are going to go by the way, and we're going to be forced to get a 5G phone, which, you know, that may be down the road, but it's out with the old, in with the new. But that happens in our own lives as well. Right? That happens in our own lives. Where we're struggling, we're trying to hang on to an old way of doing stuff. And Jesus is like, there's a much better way if you'll just let go of all of that old way of living. That old way of interacting with people. Of actions and attitudes. Of character and nature. If you just let go of all that stuff, Jesus has... I mean, I think the story alludes to the fact that Jesus has what's even better than what we've ever done before. Because the wine that Jesus creates is better in nature and taste and quality than anything else. And I think kind of the point of application is that the life that Jesus offers us today is better in quality and flavor and taste and vigor than anything that we had before. But we just got to be willing to let go of all of that old way of living stuff. Right? And so that's the challenge today. The challenge for us today is, what old way of living and things are we trying to desperately hold on to? That Jesus is saying, hey, that's who you were, not who you are or who you need to be. And that's the question that each of us have to ask and answer this morning, is what are we desperately hanging on to that represents our old life, not the life that Jesus wants us to be living? Because His way of doing things, His newness, is better in quality and taste and flavor than anything else that we've ever done in our old way of living. Now, next week, Jesus is moving out of the shadows and He's moving into the spotlight, because Jesus will show up in Jerusalem and He will do something that nobody ever thought would happen in the temple. You have to come back next week to see and read about that story in the last of chapter 2. But this is the first of Jesus' signs. There's six more Jesus does 7 in total. So you got to come back. You got to stay with us to hear about the other 6, because they'll be periodically throughout the book. But today, what old way of living things do we need to give up to experience Jesus' newness of life? Pray with me. Lord, thank you so much for this day. Thank you for your grace and mercy. Thank you for your goodness and your kindness, Lord. Thank you for all that you are doing in our hearts and lives. Thank you that you do bring newness of life, that you do bring a quality and flavor of life that is unrivaled and unparalleled by anything we could have experienced in the past or anything that we could experience that is outside of your newness. So Lord, I pray that we would give up all of the old way of living, the old way of doing things, Lord, our old life. And Lord, we would run to you to experience the newness that you offer. It's in your name we pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.